speak, but I should say that the title of my speech, which is either The History of the Future or Ask the Future of History, I'm not sure which, that title was made up by a madwoman. And the scheduling, as you probably know by now, was made up by a juvenile delinquent. But now it's my turn. And I told you about the title. The content was, to a large degree, provided to me by a former, possibly former, Episcopal priest. Richard Thieme. He wrote a book, and I wouldn't object to you buying a copy. Neither would he. There's a story behind this, and it's reasonable at a conference like this to steal a book. It happens. But I have another question for you. After I've stolen the book, and the author has seen me do it, so he knows perfectly about what's going on, is it a reasonable thing to ask him to sign? Okay. This is very good. It tells about bubbles. Mainly, the bubble that you live in, which has a membrane around it, which is difficult to detect. And he goes into quite a lot of detail about that, and I read it with considerable interest. I am going to prick some bubbles myself. I'll begin with the simplest. The word secure is derived from the Latin word, which sounds pretty much the same, securus, but it means carelessness. That is the original meaning of the word secure. It means careless. Now, is there a lesson to be learned from that? That's up to you. I ain't going to push lessons like that at all. But I will continue to some degree if these people with their million watt... I'm used to megapixels, but megawatts... okay. Now, to drift off for a moment in a... By the way, if anyone has difficulty hearing me, let me know. Anybody who wants to interrupt me, go ahead. I am a very experienced speaker, and I don't get edgy or nervous about people asking questions or intervening or saying, "Hey, Morris, you're full of it." I may ask you to, you know, provide some background for that, but I don't object to it. I haven't taken a summer course. I live rather close to the university. I think in Dartmouth, right, which is somewhere in the boondocks of northern New Hampshire. And I've been taking a summer course which is centered around the Bill of Rights. And this, in this case, I had a bubble around me that had to be pierced because I always have the Bill of Rights. And that means people can say things and you can't get prosecuted for saying things and it's not illegal to. But the Constitution, what was came into force in about 1789, they didn't get the Bill of Rights into it, but many people wanted it. And the Constitution was actually approved with the understanding that the Bill of Rights, which is the same as the current Bill of Rights, would be entered into it within a year or two. And in fact, it was. The Bill of Rights, I think, was enacted in 1791. I may be off by a few years on some of these things, but not much. But about 2 years after the adoption of the Bill of Rights, the country got into some difficulties, which led the administration, right at the beginning of the ratification of the Constitution, to suspend the Bill of Rights. It stayed suspended for some medium number of years, you know, 5 years, something like that. Then things settled down for a bit until the administration of, God help us, Abraham Lincoln, who again effectively abolished the Bill of Rights, or at least freedom of speech, for a few years, right toward the end of the Civil War. Well, I couldn't do much towards the end, of course, because he got shot, but... is it okay to tell sick jokes? The sick joke is, aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? That's really sick. Okay, but the event I'm talking about, for those that actually want to run down any of things, the first law I talked about in the 1790s was called the Alien and Sedition Act, and it made it a crime to criticize the government or the actions of the government. The second one was the suspension of habeas corpus, and those of you that ain't lawyers, you don't even know or care what the Bill of Habeas Corpus is, but it certainly puts an end to freedom of speech in many important ways. Thirdly, the third event of the sort was around the time of the beginning of World War I, when, my mind is drifting off, but it must be Woodrow Wilson, passed an act which had effect, the same general effect, and the effect on the Bill of Rights was this made it a crime to criticize the government. And then that lasted for a bit, phased out around the end of World War II, and now we have the Patriot Act. And since I believe that Ashcroft is taking attendance this morning, I won't discuss that at any great length. Now, I'll get into what some might think is closer to the subject matter involved. I told you where the talk came from and where the title came from. By the way, the name of the author here is Richard Thiem, and the book costs God knows what. Too much. This book's $35. Are you here? I would like to talk a bit about some of the realities and some of the assumptions having to do with security, particularly where it goes in the direction of cryptography, which is a strange business. And a business of people in many ways don't understand the basis for things of that sort. I should say that security and certainly cryptography are essentially economic issues. You're talking about cost, you're talking about risk-reward ratios. The United States, for example, does not intercept, decrypt the encrypted communications of third-rate countries that nobody cares about because nobody cares about them. And this is rather common. In some country that you never heard of, we probably would be unwilling to spend even 5 cents a message. I'm not too off, far off, by the way, to decrypt their traffic because there's no possibility, really, that it would be of any interest to anyone. On the other hand, other countries, and you can imagine what they are, some of them, larger countries that are not necessarily friendly to the U.S., we are going to spend a great deal of time and money interpreting their messages. But it is economic, and because of that, you're constantly in the intelligence business dealing with risk and reward and risk-reward ratios. You don't spend a buck to intercept and decrypt a message that's worth a nickel. And that is a day-to-day reality in the U.S. intelligence community of dealing with risk-reward ratios. And when somebody comes to me for advice on how they should protect their information or how they should consider exploiting someone else's information, the first questions I ask are, how much is this information worth to you? How much is the loss of this information how much of a cost is it to the country that you're dealing with? You want these ratios. And if you can put a dollar more into the process and get $10 more out on the risk-reward issues, then it's a winner. and people do this constantly. It really is viewed very strongly as an economic endeavor. I tend to know a great deal. I spent the first 25 years of my career, the labs, basically dealing with what was then the non-existent technical field of computer science. I mean, there just wasn't any such thing when I came to Bell Labs. The field itself had been created. Retired on a Friday afternoon from Bell Labs, and Monday morning went to work at NSA, very evil, and stayed at NSA until my second retirement, which was about 10 years later. And So my field was at the beginning computer science, but gradually changed into a notion of engineering rather than mathematics. And I spent much of the rest of my time dealing with problems that arose. My first job at Bell Labs was dealing with the development of a thing known then as it's changed its name a few times since, but it's the thing that's now called a modem. And when I arrived at Bell Labs, there was no such thing as a modem. People weren't even sure that they could make one. And so I spent the first couple of years there working on development of what later turned out to be modems. They didn't run at the kinds of speeds that we deal with. And we started out then, I remember the big day of all kinds of backslapping and handshaking when we got 300 speed modems going. And it gradually, or perhaps not so gradually, I don't know how much modems run at now. I mean, it's just quadzillions of things. But people often ask me, in the security area, have things changed a lot over the time that I've been dealing with it, which is now about 40 years? And the answer that I have to give people is, really, it hasn't much. I see people in many ways, development, research, attacking the same problems, by and large, as they were attacking 30 years ago. People are still writing learned papers about intrusion detection, but learned papers about intrusion detection go back almost unchanged for 30 or 40 years with very little change in the technical background of what's going on. What has changed is expectations. The expectations of what you expect from a gadget or a system. And change really has been this perception, which change in perception rather than change in the underlying technical content. What I'd like to look at just for a bit is some particular examples. We all have heard an immense amount about what was done at Bletchley Park in England with the decryption of codes coming out of the German Enigma machine. And it's characterized as a great, wondrous application of theory to the decryption of encrypted messages. And it was done by some very brilliant people in the UK who were doing some very high-class mathematics to get these methods decrypted. But that's not quite the story. In going into more detail in the story, one of the necessary things that we and the Brits did to keep decrypting Enigma messages was simply to steal copies of the machine. I mean, we would send people out with the deliberate intention that they would, for example, the Germans were critically dependent on knowing what the weather was going to be a few days from now. Because of aircraft operations, they could only send their fighters out when it was reasonable weather. Well, they had to find out the weather, and in order to be able to protect the weather a few days in advance, they would anchor some ships out around Greenland or Iceland or places like that, which were the places where they could actually get a good view of what the weather would be like 2, 3, 4 days later. And these weather ships, when they broadcast the weather reports, encrypted them with the Enigma. So where do you get an Enigma? Well, hey, you send a destroyer out to sink the weather ship and bring back the Enigma and the latest key lists for it. And this was done constantly. I think we played that game about 3 or 4 times, and the Germans never really caught on to what was going on. So that is one aspect that really doesn't have much cryptographic content in it. When the storm machines, for example, if the Brits sank a German ship of any importance, they would always go on board instantly and get the key lists for the next month or two. Constantly done. Another kind of thing that happened, which had a strong effect on cryptography, is that, for example, a military unit of no importance at all in Germany was required to send a report in every day saying what had happened during the previous day. And what they actually sent every day was the same message that they had sent every other day, namely, nothing to report. Are the German speakers here? Yeah, nichts zu melden. Which just means nothing to report. And so the Allies would get this message, which now they knew in plain text form and ciphertext form, which makes life much easier to work with when you've got the plain text and ciphertext with the same message. And this went on a constant basis. And there were other kinds of things which are not quite so dumb, but pretty dumb enough. The German military had a habit, which we don't so much have, and that was that the name of a high-ranking officer was never abbreviated. So, and titles of high-ranking German officers were unbelievably long. And I won't say one of them, because some German people here will complain about both myself spelling and pronunciation. That's Obersturmbannführer, which I can't spell anyway. But I can tell you it's 24 characters long, and that's plenty enough to get you a very noticeable piece of text in plain text and ciphertext. And referring to a high-ranking officer of that sort, the title would never be abbreviated, and also the name would never be abbreviated. If his name was Graf von Hoffenmist, it would be sent, which is another 20 characters long, excuse me. I said an inappropriate thing for German speakers. And so all these kinds of things had practically no cryptanalytic content, but they added in with the, in fact, very good cryptography that was being done in Bletchley Park in England. They added together with this to keep an almost, almost constant flow of decrypted traffic. Now, I don't mean to imply, and you shouldn't get the impression, that in some way the German people dealing with communications were dumb. Well, maybe they were dumb, but we were just as dumb. For example, there was a British code used by the British Navy during World War I, and we knew during World War I that the Germans were reading that code, and we still used it in World War II. to send important messages, well, the messages we sent in that code, which is admirably code number 2 if you care about it, detailed the route of convoys across the Atlantic. Okay? So Dumb is everywhere. And also in dealing with Dumbs, I should say that in a previous incarnation, I was a teenage military employee in Germany dealing with cryptographic systems and sending encrypted messages. And did I care much about the accuracy of that messages, or was I worried about what my girlfriend was doing that night? Well, hey. So these are some aspects of which I wanted to get to you about relatively, in talking about cryptography, relatively non-cryptographic things that happen, which could be and were extremely important to the progress of the war. Because just one of these kinds of errors wouldn't necessarily have caused a great difference, but when you have all of this kind of build-up of the sort that I described, you greatly weaken the whole communication system. And this did happen, and it happened in a fairly constant way. All sides were careless, us and the Germans and other allies, and I mean, and the documentation of this kind of stuff is so quite misleading, because you will read in any number of books how we were reading Japanese codes before and during and after the war. But what they don't tell you in these books is that the Japanese were reading our codes too. Okay? We were reading the German codes from Enigma, but the Germans were reading our codes from a machine that we had that was actually very similar in design to the Enigma. So that things are not as plain and straightforward as you might expect. Things are all mixed up with this kind of consideration that the carelessness was almost universal. I mean, a teenage code... I was a teenage code clerk. And do I care about this stuff? Well, yeah, but not terribly much. I had other problems on my mind. And this is almost universal. And screw-ups happen all the time. Another example of the kinds of things that happened is during World War II, all sides, US, UK, Germany, used machines of one kind to make their codes, to encrypt their messages. And in fact, all three of them were rather similar in design. So you look around, look at the next and you say, well, obviously the same guy designed this one as that one, which is generally true. But that made the people responsible for these messages and for these encryption systems, made them very nervous about these mechanical machines that came out before and during World War II, where you, like the Enigma, where you had some rotating wheel which did the encoding for you, and I don't intend to spend any time on the design of these things. But people got very nervous about that kind of machine protecting their communications. And what they did instead was look for and found much better methods of encryption. The scheme that was used, and it was used not just by the US, but by a large number of countries, was a thing known as one-time pad. Is that a familiar notion? Oh, Peter. Okay, I don't need to go into very much detail, except I say you take the message that you want to send and sort of glue it onto a cue list, so that what happens before the message is sent is the current cue letter and the current text letter are effectively added together. I mean, add modulo 2 is the correct detail, but they're added together so that unless you have the key message, you don't have a prayer of decrypting the message, because the message has been added character by character, or bit by bit, or whatever, and the key must is made, can be made, and was made absolutely random, so there is not even theoretically any possibility of reading the message, because you absolutely cannot find out anything about the key. Okay, I got to sort of slowly turn around. Is that what happened? Let me imagine, and I'll fuzz a few details, because although the rest of the story is not classified, it used to be, as a matter of fact. And there was a time when I was giving talks like this where the subject matter that I'm about to talk about was unclassified in the UK, but classified in the US. What do you do? Okay. It didn't work out that way. Some organization, let's call it the KGB. Yeah, well, I'll just leave it at that. They ordered a one-time tape. Obviously, they got it from the lowest bidder, right? And they got immense long-term, long keyless, and they used that to send the messages out. Worked fine. Absolutely unreadable. That's the KGB. Now, the GRU, it's a military, essentially it's a military version of the KGB. They wanted one of these one-time pad kinds of things too. So they cast around, who do you buy it from? Lowest bidder, of course. Which company? Well, it turns out it was the same company that made them for the KGB. And the people at this company said, hey, this looks exactly like the last order we got for a tape. We might as well just use the ones we made before. So now we have a major nation using what I will call for the moment two-time pads. And that lasted for 6 months?
No.
6 years? 20 years? Getting close. And this is, in fact, unclassified, and you can find out all about the story that I was telling by reading about a scheme and a system called Venona, spelled V-E-N-O-N-A, and that will tell you the whole details about how these two-time pads came into existence and the harm they do. Now, I want to get back to cost for a bit, because there are some areas in here where what's involved is just loss of money, or maybe you lose a battle, or maybe some diplomatic thing won't turn out as it should have turned out. And you can assign cost to this. And when did they get important? My own view, and having been rather close to some of these things for a period of time, is when you begin to talk in terms of human lives, you're getting serious. And did any of these things like Pomona actually threaten people's lives? Yeah. People, for example, in the U.S., whose names are is it Rosenberg? Yeah. They were basically betrayed because of this two-time pad kind of business. And so there were, in fact, human lives involved, and that can happen in a lot of circumstances. It's not particularly unusual, it really does happen. And it's at that point where I begin to find a lot of difficulty in talking about risk-reward ratios, when people getting killed on the end of this thing. Is it bothersome? Yes, it's very bothersome. And it makes it very difficult to do this kind of thing, to protect your information when you can know that a failure to protect the information adequately is going to lose some 25-year-old pilot in your Air Force. And then talking about risk-reward ratios becomes a very difficult problem. Somebody ask some questions, by the way. Do you have a question? Hey, go.
Sure.
Louder.
When I was a teenager, I was a comm center operator in the U.S. Army. This was in the 80s.
Where?
Fort Worth, Georgia.
Oh, I was in Germany at the time. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, say again.
I said I had the luxury of air conditioning all the time as a comm center operator. But it seemed, if taking what you said about plain text repeating, it seemed like the more classified a message that we were sending out, the more codes that were at the beginning of the message would say top secret, and then it would say top secret with this classification, top secret with this classification, top secret with this classification, and then there'd be another row. This, and there's a whole bunch of words that themselves were classified that would begin a very highly classified message. And it seems like I had never made this juncture before, but...
Well, you're now talking to a former teenage code clerk.
Yeah.
And so I can certainly say that what you say is certainly correct. And it involves some level of carelessness, but also some of the stuff you're talking about there is routing information, not just classification.
And the routing information came also, but it just, the more classified
the more that junk would...
The more consistent plain text you have to match up, just like with the general's names.
Yeah.
And this was the 80s. Didn't they learn that by then?
We have not gotten out of it. I mean, we're certainly aware of the problem, and things are done to try to protect that kind of information. But it's looking at it very hard, the protection is somewhat inadequate. I mean, not insanely so. It's just that it would be better if they didn't do quite so much of that kind of stuff. When a document is secret, it's likely to say secret on the top, secret. And you can't avoid that particularly. And so what you come up with is all secret messages have a beginning that in plain text looks damn near the same. It says secret. And it's bound to happen to some degree. And some steps are certainly taken to try to avoid the damage of that kind of thing. But I wouldn't say that's the worst kind of thing that happened. Did any Walker in Fort Worth ring a bell? I mean, these are people, by the way, those that don't know about it, who were selling relatively important U.S. codes for money. And one of the problems was they didn't charge enough. No, that's real. That's a very important consideration, because to just sell secrets is one thing, but at least if you sell a secret worth $1 million, you ought to be charging $1 million for it, so it costs the enemy. You want that cost to be placed in your opponent. And when Walker Fort Worth was selling this stuff at bargain basement prices, they did not, in fact, cause the cost to our opponents that should have been caused by the value of the information. Yeah. Sure.
Do you have any comments on electronic voting controversy right now? That's sort of a middle ground. It's not purely economic, but it's not really human life, but it's sort of the losses if you do it improperly.
Was it Boston or Chicago that where the notion of vote early and often came from? People think it's Boston, but actually it was Chicago, yes. Was that a daily, or was it before? Yeah, okay. I'm the wrong guy to talk to you, because I've actually looked at the design and development of these voting machines, and I wouldn't trust them with a damn myself. I think we're going to run into quite a lot of problems with that. Mostly, taking away paper. The fact that you don't have a permanent record available of what happened. But there's some electrons floating around in some machine that does God knows what. It's a dangerous way to live. It's 20 of? How can this be? I'd like to take a 5-minute break. You want to come to me, argue with each other, go on to it. Or, no, I'll give you a problem. This is a long-term problem and a hard problem, but if you work on it and make any progress, you'll find yourself much smarter at the far end than you were at the near end. When I was in Norway, I think it was Norway, about 5 years ago, well, I was there very close to the summer solstice. So I was wandering around the town at 2:00 in the morning, and there was plenty of light out. Hey, if you're in a place like that and you come to a sign which says Murmansk 60 kilometers and you point south, and I asked the lady, what country is this? And she scratched her head for a bit and she said, well, I think it's Norway. Well, I said, well, who plows the streets? Well, Norway does, but we have to pay them. So there is a triple boundary in this town that I was in between Norway, Finland, and Russia. But what I did there was I had a card about wallet size that I stuck into a machine. I punched in 4 digits in the machine, and it gave me about 2,000 crowns, whatever the hell that is. Now, there are a lot of participants in that transaction. When I put a card in the machine, punch in a pin, and it gurgles for a while and finally gives me a fairly large amount of money. There are a lot of participants in that transaction. The bank that owned the machine that gave me the money, it gave some money away. That bank wants it back. Pin is necessary to convince my own bank that I'm me, but I don't want my pin to be broadcast all over the world. My bank in the U.S. It hasn't given out or taken any money really, but there's a lot of credits involved here that it needs to be, somebody needs to charge somebody else for, you know, having more money available, even though there was actually no cash transfer. And the problem that I have in mind is, who are all the participants in an ATM transaction? And what do those participants need to satisfy their problems? And how is that in fact done? And in a general way, does the ATM system actually work in some reasonable sense? To which the answer is, by the way, is yes. The ATM system damn well works with extremely high reliability and accuracy. And surprisingly, it's quite a bit different from voting machines, as it turns out. And I'm going to sit down and rest my voice for about 5 minutes, do whatever you like. Maybe not very much. Or Kazakhstan? Are these important? I will observe that among these little countries at the southern boundary of the former Soviet Union is one country which is in fact larger than all of Western Europe. One country called Kazakhstan. Also, Kazakhstan has the greatest investment in its own infrastructure of any country in the world. They have an enormous amount of oil and they're working their butts off to get that stuff out of the ground. So is there a change here? I guess it is a change. Does it respond to your question? Who asked? Did that respond in any way to your question? I meant it to be a partial and a somewhat defective response, but a response just the same. I mean, who in the world has ever heard of Tajikistan? Who cares? But, hey, we might be sending soldiers there next month. So many if these things have changed or haven't changed. The U.S. is going to have to accept the fact that the world is a different world from what it was 40 years ago. They'll have to. They haven't yet. We've been screwing up in some ways. Oh, damn it, Ashcroft is here again. One might think that we're screwing up again by not paying the proper attention to countries that are really not countries, that are run by warlords and don't have particularly fixed boundaries. We have to deal with them in a somewhat different way than we have dealt with places in the past. And I won't speak of any religious issues. That makes things a great deal messier. In most of the places I mentioned, you go into a grocery store and what you say first is Allahu Akbar. And it's almost a necessity to speak Arabic all over Eastern Asia. Strange, but true. Another trivial question, and then I'll quit. Afghanistan borders on six other countries. Can you name them? this is a son of a gun. You might get four or five. Shall I tell you the one that you missed? You missed China.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you would miss China. And can I quit now?
Yes.
Did you have fun?
Yes.
Great.